A visit to Lystra. There was a visitor to the local zoo who happened to notice a zoo attendant quietly sobbing to himself on a nearby park bench. And being troubled by what he saw, the visitor asked another attendant, "Why is that man crying?" And the second attendant explained that one of their elephants had just died. The visitor was touched by the sad news, and then he asked, "I assume he must have been particularly fond of that elephant." And the reply came back, "No, it's not that. He's crying because he's the one that has to dig the grave." Have you ever had one of those days? Not digging graves for elephants, no. You know the ones I'm talking about. You go to work or you go to school or you simply are going about your regular activities and something out of the ordinary and negative happens. Of course you have. We've all had moments like that. We all have days that seem, despite our best intentions, to just go sideways. And most of the time we persevere, hoping that the next day will be kind of back to normal and whatever crisis we have faced will be resolved. I wonder if you've begun to notice something about the Apostle Paul in our journey. And if you haven't yet, I encourage you to pay attention as we make our way through the book of Acts to a surprising and yet disturbing trend that begins to appear. It seems that almost every time Paul shows up somewhere to preach, a riot breaks out, along with a revival. And that's odd to me because, well, most of the time when I preach, the reaction is coffee and congenial conversation. I don't know how Paul could stand it. Well, I do know how he did it. He persevered because Jesus was with him. And Ananias had told Paul, remember, way back in Acts 9, that tribulation and trouble would follow him. In Acts 14, Paul and Barnabas continue on their first missionary journey, entering the region of Lycaonia, and in particular, the city or town of Lystra. The town of Lystra was inhabited by a small remnant of the Anatolian tribe who spoke their own dialect of language. And that dialect, by the way, was spoken right up to the 6th century AD. Although Roman rule was established in this particular area, Latin inscriptions from that time tell us that the people of that town kept many of their own native customs and beliefs. Anatolia is a region of modern-day Turkey. And the ancient city of Lycra is now just a mound, a great mound of dirt. So far, to this date, it has never been dug by archaeologists. It's now located near the modern city of Latek, if you want to look that up. Now, we need to understand that Lycra is quite different from the two Antioch and Damascus and Jerusalem, because Lycra had no Jewish synagogue in its midst. There was likely no Jewish presence in this city. And the reasons for this are likely because Lycra was primarily an agricultural center of the region. It wasn't really known as a business hub. This was clearly a tight-knit community. They had a shared ethnic background. They had a distinct dialect. They had a distinct religion. That is, they followed the Greek religion. And outsiders were not warmly welcomed there. No one could come to Lystra thinking they were going to make a great profit. It would have been very difficult and challenging. The inhabitants of the city, therefore, are Gentiles, and they had a religious affiliation, as I mentioned, with the Greek gods. This is a significant thing to understand because, as we saw, Paul's strategy when he went into a city he would immediately head to a synagogue. He would first preach the gospel of Jesus to the Jews who were there and any devout Gentile believers. It was a very sound strategy because Paul could establish a sound base from which to go out from that synagogue and spread the gospel message. Paul could quote the scriptures to a Jewish audience. He could argue the truth about Jesus being the Messiah right from the scriptures. Well, he couldn't do that with Gentiles. So the question presented itself, how in the world is Paul going to reach people who don't have any biblical background at all? None. Well, God provided an opportunity, as he always does, in the form of a man who sat just inside the city gates who had been handicapped from birth. He had never walked. He is probably left there on the street by family, friends, or whoever as a beggar to ask for alms to help him get by in life. And just like in Acts 3, when Peter healed the man with a similar condition, Paul now heals this man by the power of God. And immediately it says the man got up, he starts to jump around and walk and shouting, hooray, 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 or whatever he did. And everyone in town, remember, it's a tight-knit community, everyone in town knew this man. They knew he hadn't been able to walk from birth. So how did this happen? How did he get healed? The whole town now is in a tizzy. The whole town drops whatever they are doing and rushes out to meet Paul and Barnabas. And Paul and Barnabas, remember, they've hardly gotten inside the gates of the city. At first, Paul and Barnabas may have been, wow, this is great. Look at the crowds coming to hear us. But soon, it's obvious that something is very, very wrong. Sure, Paul got their attention, but you know the expression lost in translation? That's what's going on here. Paul had expected the people of Lystra to come out in response to the healing and then be intent to listen to him as he shared the gospel message. Paul and Barnabas had walked headfirst into local custom and religion of these people. The townsfolk, having witnessed a miracle, assumed from their cultural background and their religion that Paul and Barnabas were now two of their gods in human form. In Greek mythology, some of you may know this, it was a common belief that gods often took on human form to interact with people. Quite often, they were said to procreate with humans to make demigods or half-god-like beings, like Hercules, for example. Paul and Barnabas had unwittingly triggered a collective memory of a story from way back in the misty past. It seems there was a myth in Greek mythology about the Greek gods Zeus and Hermes, or Jupiter and Mercury, if you take the Roman version, coming in human form to a town just like Lystra. In the myth, Zeus and Hermes found they were unwelcome by the residents, except for an elderly couple who invited the two gods to come into their home. And the couple were rewarded for their kindness, because out of their anger, the gods destroyed the entire town, except, of course, for that elderly couple's home. You remember, these are just simple farmers. They are very superstitious people. Lycra is not going to make the same mistake that mythical town from way back did. They didn't want their town to be destroyed. To the people of Lycra, it was logical that only a god could heal someone, so clearly Paul and Barnabas were gods in disguise. And Paul, because he was the one who spoke, was assumed to be Hermes. Barnabas was therefore assumed to be Zeus. So quickly the town rushes upon the two missionaries, not to listen to them preach, they didn't care what they had to say much, but to worship them. And at first, Paul and Barnabas, they're really confused by all this. As Jewish men, they didn't know anything about the story about Zeus and Hermes. It was unknown to them. It was actually Luke, who was a Gentile, who made the connection to this event and recorded it for us. The Jews in other towns, well, they never acted like this. This is bizarre to them. Adding to the impulsiveness of the people was the fact that the temple of Zeus was very near where the missionaries had just come into town, where that man had been healed. And word gets back to the temple priest. In haste, the priest comes with a great entourage. He comes to where the people had gathered, and he's bringing bulls, and he's bringing wreaths, and he's going to make this great sacrifice to Paul and Barnabas. And finally, the intent of what is going on here sinks in with the two missionaries, and they are, in a word, horrified. Their desire to gain the town's attention has clearly backfired. To even suggest such a sacrifice to them was an affront to their faith, both as Jewish men and, of course, as Christians. Paul and Barnabas tried really hard to reject their offer of sacrifice and praise. In fact, they do something that clearly demonstrated their disfavor with this kind of attention. They tore their clothes. They ripped them. And they run into the crowd begging them to stop their idolatry. The tearing of clothes is important because no one in the Middle East would misinterpret how upset these two men were. The crowd thought they were gods, but when they tore their clothes, they demonstrated their humanness. They were just flesh and blood. You could hear the anguish in the apostles' words. Friends, why are you doing this? We are merely human beings like yourselves. Admittedly, their words were like a wet blanket on the festivities, but it was a necessary thing. Paul and Barnabas were just ordinary men with an important message for the people of Lystra. That message, of course, was that you could only serve one true God, and the sacrifices, the beliefs of the people of Lystra or Lycra were worthless. I'm sure that went over real well. I mean, who likes to think even for a minute that your beliefs are worthless? I mean, look at all the money that we've put into the temple over the years. Oh, wait a minute, they thought. This is another idea. Hold on. Maybe this is a test. So the crowd, once again, stirs itself up into renewed vigor. And Paul and Barnabas, they just can't get these people to stop. They can't seem to get them to stop trying to worship them. What an awful mess. And it gets worse. Well, it seems that Paul and Barnabas were not the only ones to have come from Antioch. Some Jews who hated the Christians and especially hated Paul had followed them to Lycra. Paul, who hunted the Christians, now becomes the hunted. How these unnamed Jews did it, we don't know, but it says in the scriptures that the Jews got into the crowd and whipped them up into a murderous mob. The people went from worshiping Paul one minute to trying to kill him. In a rage, they dragged Paul out of the town, stoned him, and left him for dead. Then we read this amazing verse that states that the believers stood around him, and Paul just got up, walked back into the city. And the next day, he and Barnabas left for Derbe. Now, I got to ask one thing that's been niggling in my brain. Where was Barnabas when Paul was being stoned? He's not mentioned. What happened to him? I can find no clear answer other than he was probably among the believers that stood around Paul. There's something that I almost missed here that's also important. In the flurry of attempted sacrifice and stoning, there were actually people who came to believe in Jesus. We almost missed them. The believers who stood around Paul had to have come from somewhere. Despite the struggle and the opposition, the gospel took hold in a few hearts in that city. It wouldn't necessarily have been a big group, but it was a group nonetheless. And in verse 21, we read that after Paul had gone to preach in Derbe, Paul and Barnabas came back to Lycra to strengthen the believers. The one clear lesson that arises out of this passage, at least as I see it, is the church, that is you and I, must always be aware that when we speak to people, it is almost always that we speak cross-culturally. We have to understand this. Now, I need to be clear here that when I say cross-culturally in this instant, I'm speaking very broadly here. If we are believers in Christ Jesus, anyone else who does not know Jesus is in a different culture group than we are. In our Christian culture, like all cultures, we have a shared history. We have traditions. We have stories. And believe it or not, we also have words that only Christians would use. A language we understand, but non-Christians don't understand. If you randomly go up to someone who's outside the Christian culture on a street corner, even here in town, and you said something like this, "Are you redeemed by the blood of the Lamb?" They'll think you're off your rocker, won't they? Just think about how many sporting events and family events are now scheduled on Sundays and how people react when you tell them, "Oh, I can't make it, I'm going to church." How many of your neighbors actually leave their homes on Sunday morning to go to church now? Not very many, I bet. You see, the world generally doesn't get it. It is increasingly impossible to say to someone outside of Christian circles that they must do something because the Bible tells us so. Do you get what I'm trying to tell you? Your neighbors, your coworkers, other family members are likely just as confused about your faith as the people in Lycra were about Paul and Barnabas. I know myself, I have extended family members who really struggle to understand my being a minister. They don't get it. My dear departed Aunt Ruth, she used to teasingly say to me, "It must be very hard for me to explain my family to my parishioners." On the bigger stage, when one of our fellow Christians or churches does something that we deem to be very un-Christ-like, we often get painted with the same brush, don't we? I know when I hear such stories, I often say a quiet prayer, "Please don't let them be a Baptist." When Christians join to protest a social issue, we are often thought of as hot, what? Out of touch, backward, or narrow-minded, or bigoted. So first, I need to name for you what you are likely experiencing and feel quite often, but maybe you've never identified before. We as followers of Jesus are indeed different from the world. We are different. How you and I see the world because Christ dwells in us is fundamentally different than most of the world. For our own sanity and effectiveness as witnesses, we need to acknowledge this. We need to embrace the difference. It is who we are. And we can do nothing about it. And we should be unapologetic about it too. But that's another topic for another time. The question before us, as it was for Paul and Barnabas, is not how do we get people we are witnessing to think like us? Because without Christ in their lives, they're not going to think like us. But rather, how do we use our God-given creativity to bridge the gap without causing a riot? How do I reach someone who only knows the name of Jesus as a swear word? Or only knows the Bibles are those books that Gideon's place in hotel rooms? You begin by recognizing what you're up against. Paul and Barnabas were clearly caught off guard. They were blindsided. because they were unaware of the depth of the pagan religion in Lycra. They didn't know. In Jesus' words, these were a very sick people. They were living in great darkness. And Jesus told us that he came to heal the sick. And that is what those of us who have embraced Christ have experienced by being saved ourselves. We've been healed, you and I. And now we live and we serve and we socialize in a new reality. But many of our friends, and yes, even our close family, they do not. You know, Jesus' analogy of illness is really good. It helps us a lot. We are never to think of people in this world as others, as us against them. Instead, we are to see other people who are in desperate need of a cure. That's how Paul saw the people of Lycra and every place that he went. He didn't think less of them for believing in pagan gods. He just knew that he had a better path for life. Paul ached for them because he himself knew what it was like to not know Jesus. So our strategy becomes one of revealing illness and offering a cure. We must become adept at lovingly asking questions and promoting inner soul searching that reveals the emptiness of a life without Christ. We must always be ready to respond to the crises in people's lives when they don't know what to do with what's happening to them. We can say to them, I know what to do. I know who can help. Challenge is not really to get people into the church. Rather, it's to take the church, that is you and I, to the people. Why? Well, as it was my thesis in this message, that Christians of the world make up their own cultural group, then let me encourage you to go out in the world and flaunt the difference. If people get to know us and they see that we are different from the world, but in a good way, they're bound to be attracted to what we have to say. Chuck Swindoll gives a following example to make the point. He writes, "It is my opinion that the best evangelistic center in the greater metropolitan Boston area is not a church. It is a filling station in Arlington. It was owned and operated by a man named Bob, who caught the vision early in life that his vocation and his calling were welded together. As time passed, his station was known as the place to go for gas and tires and other car services. I have seen a half dozen cars lined up, bumper to bumper, near two pumps in front of that little station, waiting for that man to serve them. He doesn't have banners out front that say Jesus saves. He doesn't have flags or signs. There's no fish symbols anywhere. There's nothing plastered all over the station or in the windows. There's no sign that says bring your car to Bob and take your soul to Jesus. He simply did his job. He did it well. And people knew he was in partnership with the Lord. And he even led a dozen people to faith by just serving them as Jesus would want them to serve him. You know, most of the people you meet in life, they will not understand systematic theology. They won't get it. But they do understand fairness. They understand honesty. They understand peace. And they understand love. The world may never say this to us, but frankly, it really wants us to be different.